This podcast is a member of the Progressive Podcast Network. If you like what you hear, you can find more at newmediarevolution.org.
Hey buddies, what's up? Godless Kinzer here, podcasting to you from LSA Anaconda near beautiful sunny Balad, Iraq. It's been another week, and you know what that means. It's time once again to hunker in the bunker for another episode of Watch It Burn. Watch It Burn is dedicated to the memory of Sergeant Brian Brewster and all of our comrades who have fallen, from Captain Parker's Minuteman to the soldier of today. Welcome back to the podcast bunker, everybody. I've got some great audio today that I got from crooksandliars.com. I got the video from them, stripped the audio off of it myself. This is an amazing exchange between Michael Berg, the father of Nicholas Berg, the young businessman who was beheaded here, and his beheading attributed to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. This is Michael Berg's conversation on the phone on American Mornings on CNN with Soledad O'Brien on the news that Zarqawi was dead.
I'm curious to know your reaction as it is now confirmed that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the man who is widely credited and blamed for killing your son Nicholas, is dead.
Well, my reaction is that I'm sorry whenever any human being dies. Zarqawi is a human being. He has a family who are reacting just as my family reacted when Nick was killed, and I feel badly for that. I feel doubly badly, though, because Zarqawi is also a political figure, and his death will reignite yet another wave of revenge, and revenge is something that I do not follow, that I do not ask for, that I do not wish for against anybody, and it's an endless cycle. As long as people use violence to combat violence, we will always have violence.
Wow. That man has the forbearance of a saint. I hold no illusions about myself being able to be that forgiving of humanity if something like that were to happen to my wife or either of my boys. I probably would be calling for the perpetrators' heads, but I do not see myself as evolved a soul as Michael Berg apparently is, and good on him, more power to him. The exchange continues as follows.
I have to say, sir, I'm surprised. I know how devastated you were, your family was, frankly, when Nick was killed in such a horrible and brutal and public way.
You shouldn't be surprised, because I have never said anything but forgiveness and peace.
No, and we have spoken before, and I'm well aware of that. But at some point, one would think, is there a moment where you say, I'm glad he's dead, the man who killed my son.
How can a human being be glad that another human being is dead? Any man's death is a malicious name. That's what John Donne said, and I believe those words.
Wow. Once again, a lesson that we could all really benefit from learning. It's just amazing, this man. That mindset is just so incredibly sane compared to what's going on in today's world. And now he really breaks down the heart of the problem in so many modern conflicts.
You talked about the fact that he's become a political figure. Are you concerned that he becomes a martyr and a hero and, in fact, invigorates the insurgency in Iraq?
Of course. When Nick was killed, I felt that I had nothing left to lose. I'm a pacifist, so I wasn't going out, murdering people. But I was not a risk-taking person. And yet I've done things that have endangered me tremendously. I've been shot at. I've been shared horrible pictures. I've been called all kinds of names and threatened by all kinds of people. And yet I feel that I have nothing left to lose, so I do those things. Now, take it to someone who in 1991 maybe had their family killed by an American bomb. Their support system whisked away from them. Someone who, instead of being 59, as I was when Nick died, was 5 years old or 10 years old. If I were that person, might I not learn how to fly a plane into a building or strap a bag of bombs to my back? That's what is happening. Every time we kill an Iraqi, every time we kill anyone, we are creating a large number of people who are going to want vengeance. And we, you know, when are we ever going to learn that that doesn't work?
Now, here Soledad tries to get back on the positive talking points and tries to put the positive spin back on Al-Zarqawi's death, which is a good thing, yes, that a man like this is no longer in the world, but Mike Berg's having nothing of it. And in fact, goes ahead and goes back to what has been obscured by the recent good news.
There's an alternative reading which would say at some point Iraqis will say the insurgency is not okay, that they'll in fact be inspired by the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in the sense of he was turned in, for example, we believe, by his own Iraqi number two, number three leadership in his ranks, and that's actually them saying, you know, we do not want this kind of violence in our country. And experts who we've spoken to this morning have said this is sort of a critical moment where Iraqis need to figure out which direction the country is going to go. That would be an alternate reading to the scenario that you're pointing to.
Yeah, well, I don't believe that scenario, because every time that news of new atrocities committed by Americans in Iraq becomes public, more and more of the everyday Iraqi people who tried to hold out, who tried to be peaceful people, lose it and join the, what we call the insurgency, what I call the resistance against the occupation of a one sovereign nation.
Setting aside the possibility that Zarqawi's own people under him that wanted to move up in the organization saw this as a perfect chance to have somebody else do the dirty work and save themselves from being scrutinized from within by letting the Americans do their dirty work, Soledad attempts once again to turn back to a talking point, an administration talking point, and Mike Berg shoots her down.
There's a theory that a struggle for democracy, I mean, we have, you know,
democracy?
The parliament.
Come on, you can't really believe that that's a democracy there when the people who are running the elections are holding guns. That's not democracy.
Soledad doubles back now and tries to rephrase so that she can try to enforce the you've got to break a few eggs frame. But Michael Berg really breaks it down.
There's a theory that as they try to form some kind of government, that in fact it's going to be brutal, it's going to be bloody, there's going to be loss, and that's the history of many countries, that's just a lot of people pay for what they believe will be better than what they had under Saddam Hussein.
Well, you know, I'm not saying Saddam Hussein was a good man, but he's no worse than George Bush. Saddam Hussein didn't pull the trigger, didn't commit the rapes. Neither did George Bush, but both men are responsible for them under their reigns of terror. I don't buy that. Iraq did not have Al-Qaeda in it. Al-Qaeda supposedly killed my son. Under Saddam Hussein, no Al-Qaeda. Under George Bush, Al-Qaeda. Under Saddam Hussein, relative stability. Under George Bush, instability. Under Saddam Hussein, about 30,000 deaths a year. Under George Bush, about 50,000 deaths a year. I don't get it. Why is it better to have George Bush be the king of Iraq rather than Saddam Hussein?
Michael Berg is the father of Nicholas Berg, the young man, young businessman who was beheaded so brutally in Iraq back in May of 2004. Joining us by phone from Wilmington, Delaware. Mr. Berg, thank you. Thank you for talking with us this morning.
Well, that didn't go at all like Soledad and so many of the corporate media hope it will go. They have a mindset that is hostile to anybody who has lost family members in the current ongoing conflict, who does not toe the administration line. And you see that with Ann Coulter recently attacking the 9/11 widows who have been active in trying to find out what really happened to their husbands. The attitude on that side of the aisle is that only they are allowed to use the dead to promote their message. And they want you to believe that anybody who has ever died as a result of terrorist activity or guerrilla activity in the current conflict is a good supporter of the current administration, and therefore, you know, what they what's being done is justified and is legitimized to basically avenge their sacrifice. And as we can see from the Jersey Girls, the 9/11 widows, and from Mike Berg, that is not always the case. And I would urge you to go to a website that has a little more on the history of al-Zarqawi and how he became as big a figure in Iraq as he was purported to be. And it's a long URL, so I went ahead and went to tinyurl.com. Just type into your browser address bar tinyurl.com/z5yx6. That's Zulu 5 Yankee X-ray 6. And that will take you to an article with a little more backstory on Zarqawi. And I'll call that the end of my first segment.
Radio First Terminer, Iraq. This is Dave Rabbit, from Saigon to the desert sands.
And everywhere beyond and in between.
Hard acid rock music and good times for the American men and women on the front lines. Radio First Terminer, Iraq. Coming soon to a war near you.
From the 10 June 2006 Mideast edition of Stars and Stripes. Poll: Americans support the troops, oppose war. Now, anybody who listens to the podcasts and the radio shows that I listen to that are left of center will have the same reaction as I do. No shit. Fucking duh. It's plainly obvious. The only people who say that if you don't support the war, you don't support the troops are those on the other side of the aisle who don't support the troops, who would prefer to see us keep dying. And I don't think that's very supportive, actually. You know, and they're also the type that continue to vote in congressmen who allow our benefits for both active duty and for veterans to continually be cut, and allow things like a budget that does not include any money for Iraq reconstruction anymore. People who don't give a damn about anything but their poll numbers. And from the article, it says within the article that the survey was completed Wednesday shortly before the announcement that U.S. airstrikes had killed Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and the Iraqi parliament's approval of candidates for ministers in charge of the army and police. It remains to be seen how those events could affect opinion, especially among a public paying close attention to war dispatches. Some 76% of those questioned said they were following reports about allegations that U.S. troops killed unarmed Iraqi civilians, which in itself makes me suspicious of the timing of the killing of Zarqawi, not to mention the fact that supposedly he was in the immediate vicinity of a half ton of ordnance going off, and his body was still in such good shape. But anyway, that's just my tinfoil hat wearing there, and my cynicism that's been engendered and nurtured under the current political climate. The article continues, the military is investigating reports that a small number of Marines killed 24 Iraqi civilians, including unarmed women and children, in the town of Haditha on November 19th. It is also conducting a probe of an incident in Hammamdia following allegations that Marines pulled an unarmed Iraqi man from his home on April 26th, then shot him to death without provocation. Regardless of whether the allegations turn out to be true, 63% of those surveyed said they thought the killings of civilians were isolated incidents. That view was especially true among Americans over 35, whites, and those living in the South, where the military has a strong presence. Now, being military and having been stationed in the South for the past 5 years, I can say I'm not surprised that there would be such support in the South, because I've seen the mentality there that they are, as George Carlin calls them, badge suckers and uniform sniffers. They tend to have a almost reverential attitude towards authority, which I think is, frankly, I believe is unhealthy. It's unhealthy as an American to be so deferential to authority. It's not what our country is founded on. While the AP poll found that most Americans are willing to give U.S. troops the benefit of the doubt, their misgivings about the war and the prospect of Iraq establishing a stable democratic government are growing. 59% said the United States made a mistake in going to war, a new high and a significant jump from 34% in December 2004.
Despite President Bush's pronouncements about Iraq setting up a viable government, only 44% of those polled said it was likely they would see a stable government in Baghdad. It was a new low in the survey. My personal opinion is that this whole wreck can be salvaged. It really can, but it will take an entirely different tactical and strategic mindset than is currently being used. Now, I'm not an expert on strategy, and my tactical experience only extends as far as being an infantry fire team leader, only having three other guys under me, and acting as a squad leader on a number of, you know, isolated short-term occasions. But as an infantryman at the time, my the knowledge I gathered was only limited to, like I said, a four-man team, including myself as a leader. So my theory is based on the book Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, Counterinsurgency Lessons from Malaya and Vietnam by John A. Nagel. Now, this book, which basically takes lessons, a lot of lessons from our experience in Vietnam, is apparently being recommended by officers here to other officers that are incoming. And so people want to say there's no comparison between this and Vietnam. Well, our own officers are basically telling each other that yes, there is. And Nagel points out that when he deployed to Iraq to practice counterinsurgency as an ops officer for 1st of the 34th Armor, he learned a lot about the nature of insurgencies. He had begun research into the book 8 years before he went to Iraq, before he came here, and he had it published actually a year, in its first edition was published a year before he deployed here. And so his new edition, he has changed up a little bit, you know, from what he has learned. And he says in his foreword that T.E. Lawrence's aphorism that making war upon insurgents is messy and slow like eating soup with a knife is difficult to fully appreciate until you've done it. Intellectually grasping the concept that fighting insurgents is messy and slow is a different thing from knowing how to defeat them. Knowing how to win, in turn, is a different thing from implementing the measures required to do it. Now, he points out that in Vietnam, we began adapting our army to what could have been a very effective counter to the guerrilla tactics being used there, but it was too little too late. And by contrast, he says, the army has adapted much more rapidly to the challenge of insurgency in Iraq. My own personal experience is illustrative of the larger challenge and response. Task Force 134 Armor was preparing for high-intensity combined arms warfare in July of 2003 when it was notified it would deploy to Iraq. By September, two of its three tank companies were conducting combat operations in the Sunni Triangle, mounted on Humvees and dismounting to fight as Dragoons, with just one company fighting from M1A1s. That is our main battle tank, the M1A1. In the intervening 60 days, the battalion had been issued new weapon systems and vehicles ranging from machine guns to up-armored Humvees. It reorganized its combat vehicle crews and maintenance teams, designed and implemented counterinsurgency training, and deployed halfway around the world to fight a kind of war that, if not new, was new to the soldiers of Task Force 134 Armor. And he points out that you really need institutional change in our current force structure and our current tactical doctrine to be able to possibly salvage this. And he also points out in his foreword, the United States is working diligently in Iraq as it did in Vietnam to improve the lives of the people. Dollars or bullets in this fight? Well, that's as of this edition. Since then, of course, all money for reconstruction has been taken out of the budget. But anyway, the Commander's Emergency Response Program, SERP, which provides field commanders funds to perform essential projects, wins hearts and minds twice. Once over by repairing infrastructure and again by employing local citizens who are otherwise ready recruits for the insurgents. SERP is helping with the painstaking process of building relationships with the Iraqi people, resulting in some intelligence from those we help, but not enough, not yet. And he basically points out that local forces are an irreplaceable part of this. Since writing the book, he understated the importance of local forces in defeating an insurgency and the difficulty of raising, training, and equipping them. Creating reliable, dedicated local forces during the course of an insurgency that targets not just the local soldiers and police, but also their families, truly is a task as difficult as eating soup with a knife. Local forces have inherent advantages over outsiders in a counterinsurgency campaign. They can gain intelligence through the public support that naturally adheres to a nation's own armed forces. They don't need to allocate translators to combat patrols. They understand the tribal loyalties and family relationships that play such an important part in the politics and economics of many developing nations. They have an innate understanding of local patterns of behavior that is simply unattainable by foreigners. All these advantages make local forces enormously effective counterinsurgents. It is perhaps only a slight exaggeration to suggest that on their own, foreign forces cannot defeat an insurgency. The best they can hope for is to create the conditions that will enable local forces to win it for them. Now, just from what I've read on the foreword, if this book really lives up to the promises and the objectives put in it, I would say that it should be required reading of all officers that deploy here. And it should definitely be required reading up to the highest levels of CENTCOM, and possibly all the way up to the top of DOD, because the current strategy, from what I have seen and what I have read and heard and all that, and mind you, my experience is limited, being as I am not allowed outside the gates anymore. Not this time around. But from what I've seen, we're pretty much making very, very slow progress where we make progress at all. There has not really been a significant backslide as such that I have seen, but there have been, you know, incidents here and there and cases here and there in certain areas where, yes, that has been the case. There has been some backsliding. But for the most part, it's kind of been a holding action as far as I can see. So any kind of fresh approach is definitely a welcome thing, and I encourage anybody in a command position to get a copy of this book and read it. I am going to try to get a copy for myself and see just what, from my own tactical experience, is viable advice.
Hello, this is Euro Satan. After a long day of tormenting, I love to download the Sooner Thought podcast. It keeps me up to date with political news, commentary, and satire, great interviews with authors and newsmakers of the day, and of course, we must not forget the Euro Satan interview, in which Alex and I discuss the lighter side of the darker side of the world. Tune in at soonerthought.libsyn.com or search iTunes for Sooner Thought. Tell them the devil made you do it.
That, of course, is the Euro Satan from the Sooner Thought podcast, another member of the Progressive Podcast Network. And I want to say, folks, if you're listening to this, you have a computer. Or, well, okay, I'd say 90% chance you have a computer and an internet connection. Which means all you need to make your own podcast is a freeware program such as I use. I use Audacity. It's great. It's been perfect for my needs. Real easy to use, really simple to figure out, and a cheap microphone, or better yet, just a headset microphone and headphones combo like I'm using. And mine was only $16, and it's pretty decent quality. And you can make your own podcast. I mean, cripes, I'm doing it from Iraq, for God's sake. All I've got that I'm using is I have a borrowed laptop, a cheap-ass headset, and Audacity. And a shitload of music that I have from my MP3 player that, well, that crapped on me, but I managed to get a few of the songs onto the roommate's computer before it happened. And songs from his external hard drive, as well as some that have been donated to me on another MP3 player that I was given by one of my wonderful listeners. So like Christian said on his promo, and like we say all the time at the network, if you're fed up with what the corporate media is telling you, if you're fed up with hearing them lie about the truth you see right in front of your own eyes, then what you need to do is stand up, make your voice heard, and become the media. And as soon as you get that started, go ahead over and go to newmediarevolution.org and join up with our network. Get the word out. We're trying to start up the badly, desperately, vitally needed echo chamber that the progressive movement needs in order to win the war for democracy and take our country back for what is right and what is good and what is just. To take our country back from those who use the politics of fear. And we want to bring back the politics of hope. Because we know that there is nothing Americans can't do when we set our minds to it. There is no obstacle we can't overcome. There is no good that we cannot achieve. There is no noble goal that we cannot fulfill when we set our minds to it, we will no longer be angry, frightened victims. We are going to stand up. We're going to be heard. We're going to take our country back, because it is our very survival at risk here. And I see this as a natural extension of my military oath of service. What I am doing here is just one more way that I do what I can to defend the Constitution of the United States of America. And I urge all of you out there, if you like what you hear on our network, and you're sick of corporate media lies, or corporate media omissions, or minimizing, or delegitimizing causes and issues that you see are important, then by all means, goddamn, do it yourself, take the media back, and join us. Join the new media revolution. Dollars to donuts, you can't tell me who that banjo player was. But you also have forgotten that before he was very successful as a film actor, he was an insanely successful stand-up comic in the 70s. And I don't know. I know it and you don't know it. Haha. Maybe one of you does. I doubt it, though. That's such an obscure little piece that it's hard to expect you to know. But if you think I'm gloating over it, or, you know, presenting myself as superior to you in some way for knowing that, I'll just give you a hint by saying, well, excuse me! And maybe that'll jog some of you's memories if you're of a certain age or older. But anyway, moving on, I'm going to go now into the my asides and my off of the bigger stuff. I'll say taking a rest from the big work for a little while and just talking about, you know, daily life here. And one thing that struck me is important enough to mention, because those of progressive bent tend to be a little more interested in what they put in their mouths as well as what they put in their heads. I had just had a meal that was quite lovely. It was a just an instant rice noodle soup from Thai Kitchen, and it's their garlic and vegetable one, and it struck me as kind of cool because it's very fucking good. I mean, this was just an awesome soup. I don't even think I put in the right amount of water and it was still good. But it's, like I said, it's an instant rice noodle soup, and the thing that struck me that I thought was pretty cool about it is that it noodles are 100% natural, wheat-free, gluten-free, cholesterol-free, egg-free, steam-cooked, not fried. And yet they still have 20% of my daily recommended allowance of sodium in them, but hey, you know, nothing's perfect. But I was just pretty impressed by them. I mean, hell, really good too. I mean, shallot, garlic, and onions, basil, ginger, chili, sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup. So I was pretty impressed. It's pretty damn tasty. I'm gonna go ahead and go to their website and see if I can order stuff directly from them, or maybe I'll go to NetGrocer and see if they've got them, because I'd ask the wife to send me stuff like this, but she's got better things to do. I mean, yeah, she sends me packages and stuff, don't get me wrong, but I don't want her spending all of her time at the damn store looking for just certain things for me, because I can eat just fine over here. I mean, sure, I'm eating, you know, mass-produced cafeteria food, so it's, you know, pretty, sure, it's probably pretty bad for me, and I'll eventually end up with butthole cancer. But I just have to say, I recommend Thai Kitchen, definitely. And maybe hopefully someday I can get them to pay me for saying stuff like that. Of course, I totally negated any kind of health benefits of that by immediately following it up by a dessert of Little Debbie's peanut butter wafers, which are pretty much straight lard as near as I can tell. But well, damn, they're tasty.
Where the hell is your
How about another one from the Stars and Stripes, same edition, Saturday, June 10th, 06. Maryland man accused of plotting attack on abortion clinic. Riverdale, Maryland, a man who told police he made a pipe bomb to attack an abortion clinic was arrested Thursday, shortly before the device went off in a friend's home while authorities tried to disable it, according to court documents. No one was injured by the explosion, which started a fire that burned the top floor of the Riverdale home, officials said. Some friends of Robert F. Weiler, Jr. had tipped off police about the 25-year-old's alleged plans Wednesday night. Weiler then called the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or the Party Bureau, if you grew up in Bonita, Oregon, as I did, and surrendered to state troopers at a rest stop on Interstate 68 just after midnight. Investigators found a handgun and ammunition in his car, officials said. According to an ATF affidavit, Weiler planned to bomb an abortion clinic in Greenville and use a .40-caliber handgun he had stolen from a friend to, quote, shoot doctors who provided abortions. Weiler faces four federal counts, including making a destructive device and possessing an illegal handgun. He was being held Thursday. Phone messages left at Weiler's home were not returned. A car in the driveway had a frame around the front license plate that read, quote, choose life, end quote, God is pro-life, end quote. A woman who answered the phone at the Greenbelt Clinic said they had not heard of the threat. In 1989, 80 abortion opponents were arrested for trespassing in a demonstration outside the clinic. Well, one thing I noticed is that the term terrorism and the term terrorist was not used at all in the article, and I doubt this man will be charged under any of the Patriot Act provisions, though I could be wrong, I could be mistaken, but I am pretty sure that apparently if your motives are Christian, you're not considered a terrorist, even if the intent and the results are exactly the same, which is, I think it's a disgusting double standard. If you seek to use violence to coerce others into a different political course of action, that's terrorism, plain and simple. That is as simple a definition as I can come up with. And look at the grand scheme of things, that's war. never mind that. That's just, you know, getting a little too complicated and reading too much into geopolitical situations.
We had to dedicate this one to the draggy scene that's going on. All the soldiers that are fighting in Chicago and Milwaukee and New York. Oh, yes, and all the soldiers fighting in Vietnam. We had to do a thing called machine gun.
Days ago, I saw a movie called Sir No Sir that I have to say was incredible. I'm one of the rare Americans that loves documentaries anyway, and I am a great student of history, as I've mentioned before. I love history, especially American military history. And to see, though, that, I had already known about the GI anti-war resistance movement during the Vietnam War, but to see it all put together in one place and to hear the voices and see the faces and hear the stories from their own words of the people who were involved at the time just was, it was amazing to me. It was awesome. And I'm going to have to ask around over here and see who else has seen it and what they thought. And I highly recommend it to anybody out there. Go to sirnosir.com and find where you can see it yourself, because it is, words fail me. I don't know what else to say, but just that I loved it. And if you're an active duty service member, you can get yourself a copy of it by going to ivaw.net and sign up with them. You don't have to sign up to join the organization. You can just request a copy and they'll send it to you free. Really, really interesting. One last thing from Stars and Stripes, 10 June 2006, Mideast Edition. Texas seeks webcams along border. I have to say, I also heard Mark Maron talking about this on one of his shows a couple days ago. But anyway, El Paso, Texas. Governor of Texas wants to turn all the world into a virtual posse. Governor Rick Perry, Mr. Goodhair, has announced a $5 million plan to install hundreds of night vision cameras on private land along the Mexican border and put the live video on the internet so that anyone with a computer who spots illegal immigrants trying to slip across can report it on a toll-free hotline. Wow. You know, I'm reminded of some old punk rock lyrics. Land of the brave, that's what they think. Home of the slave, nation of finks. So here we go. It's yet another attempt at instilling snitch culture in the U.S. Wow, just crazy, you know? God. The kind of people that these people want us to become is just frickin' disgusting. A nation of informer serfs. It's just despicable. You know, that kind of servile slave mentality is not... It is far beneath anyone who is worth the title of American. And that's it. I'm going to wrap it up for the night. Well, for this episode. I don't know if it's going to be for the week or whatever, but anyway, it's about 3:23 in the morning here, and I have a few things I have to get done before daylight. So if you have a topic you'd like me to discuss, go ahead and give me a call at 1-888-82-REVOLT. And leave a message on the voicemail there. Or you can email me at watchitburn, one word, at godlesskinzer.com, K-I-N-S-E-R. Or you can fax at 120-MUTT-ANUS. And I promise you that next time I'm not going to promise because I'll forget it by then. But next time I'm going to try to remember to get the actual numbers for that. Had it written down somewhere so I don't have to keep saying MUTT-ANUS at you every episode. But yeah, go ahead and call, email, fax, whatever. I would normally have a couple listener calls to throw in here, but nobody's called in a while. I mean, come on, it's toll-free for y'all if you're in the U.S. I mean, I'm the one that pays for it. I'm paying a couple bucks a month for that, so, you know, hey, help me out. Make it worth it. Even if you hate me, despise me, I mean, you know, tell me to fuck myself. I don't care. I'll play it. Just because, well, it's funny. And so, with that, take care, everybody. Thanks again, folks, for spending a little time in the bunker with me. If you like what I'm doing and you want to help support me in this endeavor, you can go to my website, godlesskinzer.com, K-I-N-S-E-R, and you'll see an Amazon Honor System pay box on the right sidebar there. You can click on that and make a donation if you'd like, or you can also check out some of my sponsors and buy a t-shirt or something. I would also encourage you to support the New Media Revolution at newmediarevolution.org, where you can listen to other members of the Progressive Podcast Network. So until next time, take care of yourselves and watch your six.